We are now about to, as we begin our conversation with the workers from Johns Hopkins, who have been on strike, demanding higher wages and more. We're going to hear their voices and Jeff Singer as well in the studio. We want to bring you a report that our producers did last week on the line with the workers. Here it is.
Hello, I'm Mark Unnery, producer for The Mark Steiner Show. I'm here with fellow producer Stephanie Mavronis at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, where about 100 striking workers and supporters are picketing on a sunny Thursday afternoon. We spoke with one of the Hopkins employees on strike, Yvonne Brown, an environmental services worker. I asked her why she was on the picket line.
For better wages, better contract. Been here 19 years, almost 19 years in August, and I'm only making $12.97 an hour. 62 years old. I'm ready to retire early. Can't afford to because of the low wages. I have to depend on outside agencies to help me with my gas and electric, my rent and all of that because of the low wages that we make. So it's a struggle. It's a struggle to work here at Hopkins. They want top performance, but they don't give us anything where we feel appreciated. You know, I think they'd get more respect, more better service out of people if they was to treat us right. So,
do you think Hopkins has been negotiating in good faith?
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. They could care less. They just nickel and diming us, you know.
What are you all asking for right now?
We're asking for $15.15. People to be brought up to $15 that's been here 15 years. So we're willing to work with them, but they're not being fair. They're not meeting us any kind of way. They're still trying to keep us below poverty level, which they think is a good level, but it's not.
Nicholas Davenport is a student at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. I asked him why he was supporting the strike.
I guess for a couple reasons. For one thing, just as a social worker, I'm a social work student in the health field, and you know I know that promoting health isn't just about medical care; it's about social justice. You know, if people don't have the resources to have a stable living environment, to buy healthy food, to have a safe environment for their kids, then people aren't going to be healthy. You know, and I think that the healthcare industry is pretty notorious for exploiting its workers. So I think it's incredibly important that workers are standing up. I'm also part of the Healthcare is a Human Right campaign, which is trying to organize to get universal healthcare in the state of Maryland. And, you know, I really think that viewing healthcare as a human right also means we need to look at the human rights of healthcare workers.
What do you all mean by healthcare as a human right?
Well, right now, healthcare is viewed as a commodity in this country. You know, unlike most industrialized countries where everyone has access to publicly provided health insurance, healthcare here is something that you have to buy, you know, and lots of people can't afford it. And of those of us who can afford it, often our coverage is very bad because provided by insurance companies who are trying to make a buck rather than actually provide for the public health. So we're trying to create a healthcare system that values health as something that everyone should have access to. And that means that the healthcare system should be designed in a democratic way that, you know, everybody has a say in how it's run, and that includes healthcare workers. So that's part of why I'm here.
Hopkins is a very unfair place to work. It's just that jobs are so hard out here to get now, and I've been here so long. I did have a second job, but I can't do it anymore because of my age and everything. So I thank God I have a job, but to be appreciated is another thing. They have billions of dollars. They know, and it's not going anywhere. It's not going to where it's going at. We got to ask Ron Peterson that. But it's not going to the hard workers, the ones that's in there risking their life and their health. We deal with all kinds of diseases, all kinds of cleaning up and all of that, you know. So physically and mentally, it takes a toll on you. So I think we should be paid fair for the work that we're doing, but we're not.
That was Yvonne Brown, a striking environmental services worker at Johns Hopkins Hospital. You also heard Nicholas Davenport, a student at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. For fellow producer Stephanie Mavronis and The Mark Steiner Show, this is Mark Gunnery.
And that was our report. There's too much echo in here. Can we fix that, please? And that was our report here on that our producers did at the Hopkins strike. We are joined here in studio by Daniel Roberts, who's a transporter who's been working at Johns Hopkins a year and a half and makes $12.50 an hour as a member of SEIU Local 1199. Good to have you in the studio.
It's good to be here.
It's a storied union. Carrietta Hires is with us in the studio. She's a longtime SEI 1199 organizer at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. She's been present at the ongoing contract talks between the workers and the hospital. Carrietta, good to have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
Your reputation precedes you. Good to have you here. Jeff Singer's in the studio. He's founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless and teaches now at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. And wrote this interesting piece, a letter actually, to the editor in the Baltimore Sun outlining why Johns Hopkins could afford to pay their workers more. And he's here just to be able to throw all those facts on the table that he's been researching and talk about that. We did ask Hopkins to join us. They sent a statement instead and said they could not join us. And I wrote other people at Hopkins asking them to please bring people here, even if they want to do a one-on-one and not a debate with the workers, which was fine. But did not hear back from them about that either. So we did very, very hard try to reach out to the folks at Hopkins. They wrote here saying this. This is the official statement from their press people, then we'll launch into our conversation. Thanks to careful planning and hard work on the part of so many Johns Hopkins employees, we have been able to conduct business as usual at the hospital, focusing as we always do on providing world-class care to our patients and their families. The workers represented by the union are primarily maintenance and food service workers. There are approximately 2,000 of the nearly 20,000 people working at and providing services for the Johns Hopkins Hospital, which includes employees, medical staff, and trainees. These union-represented employees, like all of our employees, are important members of the Johns Hopkins team. They do not provide direct clinical patient care, though they support all of our clinical areas and operations. We had a contingency staffing plans in place to assure no disruptions to our patients and their families would take place. We remain hopeful that continued good faith efforts toward negotiating will result in a contract that all parties feel is fair and equitable. That was sent by Kim Hopp, who is Director of Media Relations and Public Affairs at Johns Hopkins Medicine. So that's their statement. And I see at the end of our table, Carrietta Hires is smiling. I'm curious what you're smiling about.
I'm actually smiling because of the statement. Our unit actually represents surgical techs, pharmacy techs, supply coordinators, instrument processors, OR support associates, radiology transport, general transport, then maintenance of all the facilities, EVS, linen, and dietary.
All of that. Mm-hmm. So tell me about what's at the heart of this strike for both of you. Start with you, Carrietta, then I'm going to come over to Daniel and hear his thoughts on what he does for a living and what it means to him. But talk about what's at the heart of this strike at the moment.
For us, the actual heart of this is raising what we call the floor level up. And that's what when we're talking about our more senior workers who have been there for at least 15 years or more and who have yet to be able to make at least $15 an hour. Initially, folks were talking about, we have to change the multiplier on the pension. We have to do this. But there's no need in changing the multiplier on the pension if you're not making that hourly wage.
And you've been working at Hopkins for how long? Right now, Daniel?
A year and a half.
Tell me about your job. What's your job there?
I'm a general service patient transporter.
And what does that mean?
I transport patients back and forth through the hospital all over Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins Hospital is a pretty big campus.
Yeah.
I get asked on a daily basis how long did it take you to learn the Hopkins Hospital, and I also get asked how far do you walk a day. I think one day I had on a pedometer on my phone.
Yeah.
And it didn't tell me the miles, but it told me the steps. In just 6 hours, I walked 39,000 steps.
Well, you must be in shape.
I like to think so.
But that's, I mean, all joking aside, I mean, that's a lot. And I, and so your work actually is really direct patient service, because you're talking to, working with, and transporting patients across the hospital for various tests or whatever they have to do, right?
Yes. I transport beds, stretchers, wheelchairs. I even do ambulatory. I get to talk a lot with the patients and hear their story and actually listen to, you know, how they feel. You know, I try to give an encouraging word, you know, throughout the day, you know, to different patients that may be going into something that's very frightening. You know, sometimes you have some patients going into life-threatening surgeries.
Right.
And so, you know, just to, you know, provide them, you know, with a quick word or some type of encouragement, you know, to help them out.
I mean, well, I asked that question because I think it's important, Daniel Roberts, that the men and women who you represent, just with your voice, do similar work. I mean, is the humanity in your job, is the part of your job that's more than just pushing a patient or a bed across campus from one place to the other? It's the interaction you have that is part of medical care.
Very important.
Right?
Yes.
Now, I don't think I'm making too much of that, because, I mean, you know, you're
absolutely,
you know,
not.
I think not. I grew up in a medical family, and I understand how those things work. Mm-hmm. And so the question here, what Hopkins is saying also in the paper, I mean, the folks at Johns Hopkins were saying in the articles I wrote, both in the Baltimore Sun and the Baltimore Brew, which cover this pretty intensely in different ways, they're saying that the pot of money is not just not there. They're offering step salaries coming up to what do they say? It's now $12. Maybe they'll go to $14. Mm-hmm. But that money in that particular part of Hopkins was not there. And Jeff Singer, you wrote a piece in the Sun that kind of takes that on a little bit.
Yes, I don't have access to any of the proprietary data at Johns Hopkins, but I know how to get on the internet and find their tax forms. It's called the 990. They do this filing, and according to their tax forms,
right,
Hopkins has both very large assets and a good deal of income. Nonprofits, you know, and Hopkins is one, need to have more money at the end of the year than they started with, or else they'll go out of business. And in the Hopkins case, for their latest 990 on the internet, they had revenue over expenses of $84 million. Now, that's less than they had the year before and the year before that. The hospital business is a difficult one for sure. Nonetheless, $84 million would be about 28 times what they need to pay a decent wage to the folks that work there. Hopkins wouldn't be the number one hospital in the U.S. without people like Carrietta and Daniel and many other people I met while walking the picket line there. So these core employees deserve a living wage, and they're not getting a living wage.
Yeah, I do want to get to that point, too, because I've made several comments on the air about this, where I've said we have taken on Walmart for their low wages and not paying their workers enough so that it ends up that their workers are on Medicaid and on food stamps because they don't have enough to live on. And your argument, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Carrietta, the same situation takes place at Hopkins.
Yeah, absolutely. It was rather startling. We had one of our union employees, you know, talk to me and began crying. And I'll call her daughter number two. And I'm like, what, you know, what's wrong? She said, I've been working here for 9 years. I go to school. I take care of my three kids. But I never realized that I was making poverty wages until I was able to see it in print. And it's heart-wrenching because I represent these workers, and just talking to them on a daily basis, some things we just like take for granted. You know, you're the mother to everybody. Once you get to know them, they're like in your family.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, you get a couple of dollars here, you do this. But then just to sit and listen and talk to these folks, we were at the table, and the attorney said, well, we appreciate you having, you know, a few of your members give us their stories. But, you know, we think that we're giving you a fair proposal. The sad part is that you may have only been able to view three or four of the workers, but it's hundreds, and it shouldn't be the norm at such a prestigious place as Johns Hopkins Hospital. It just should not happen.
So one quick question for you, Carrie, before I move back to Daniel and Jeff. One of the quotes in the paper from the union was the percentage that these raises would take out of the take out of the Hopkins budget.
Yeah, well, when we did it, they told us, we gave them the proposal. They sat in stone shocked and said that the proposal would cost them $12 million. Four-year contract would cost them $12 million. And they told us that it took their breath away. It took their breath away. Now, mind you, Jeff just said $84 million in 1 year. But a four-year contract would cost them $12 million. And it took, actual words, it took their breath away.
So we're talking $3 million a year this contract might cost.
That's it.
And
32 cents.
What do you mean 32 cents?
It would cost them 32% of the total payroll cost is what would cost Hopkins for this contract. That's it. 0.32.
So before we come back to Jeff, and kind of I want to go back and to talk about the salaries and questions of Hopkins and where money could come from. And I think this is really a critical point. I'm glad you researched this. Daniel, I mean, you're a single man, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. But even a single person living on, what did you say, $12 an hour?
Yes.
So what? How do you live on $12 an hour? How do you live on $12 an hour?
It is it's rough. I just in gas going back and forth from Parkville to Hopkins.
Which is where you live, obviously, Parkville.
Yes, mm-hmm. Parkville. I live in Parkville. Just going back and forth 5 days a week is it's rough. It's rough because, you know, everything is going up. You know, I still, you know, I do live at home, but I still do, you know, provide for myself. I still, you know, do the, you know, wash my clothes, you know, buy things for the house, you know, give my mom something. And it's still, you know, I still am in need of, you know, more money because I don't want to have to struggle. I don't want to have to, you know, I just want to make it easier for me and my mom. I'll say that.
I mean, because at a $15 an hour rate, that would be like $31,000 a year, maybe a bit more if it's $15.50 or whatever that was, but that's approximately that. That would be a huge boost.
An amazing boost.
I mean, because if you thought about two hospital workers making $31,000 a year, two people making that salary together, say they were married or living together, whatever, you're talking about a couple being able to live on $60,000 a year, you can begin to live on that.
Mm-hmm.
Begin to live on that in this country.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's not going to make them rich, but they can at least have their head above the water.
Right.
Well, speaking of rich, the CEO of Hopkins Hospital, fine man, I know him. He's been generous to organizations with which I have worked. However, his annual compensation is more than the cost annually of bringing the workers up to a living wage. Larry Page, you know, one of the founders of Google, takes a salary of $1 a year because he wants to make sure that the company has, you know, rich benefit packages and pays their workers reasonably well. And maybe that's an idea for other CEOs around here, because the distinction now between the wage that the Hopkins workers earn and the CEO's salary is 156 to 1. The CEO earns 156 times what the starting wage is. And, you know, there's been an awful lot of talk about income inequality. President Obama recently said, income inequality is the defining issue of our times. But it's time that we put our money where our talk is. We can reduce income inequality, for sure, but we have to start somewhere. And I would say that Hopkins is the leading hospital in the nation, could start by reducing income inequality and paying this living wage. They can clearly afford it. Their assets in their last 990, their assets were $470 million. That means that that's what they have essentially sitting around.
You're talking about, when you say assets, are you talking about real estate? What are you talking about?
Well, yes, we're talking about real estate, but we're also talking about treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities. They have over $25 million in mortgage-backed securities. They could easily take one source of their assets and put them in essentially a lockbox and keep that money for nothing but investing in their employees. It wouldn't harm one current employee. It wouldn't reduce the number of employees who, by the way, compensation is over $500,000. They have 13 people on the Hopkins payroll whose compensation is over $500,000 a year. And yet they can't afford to pay more than a non-living wage. They can't afford to bring the salaries beyond the food stamp requirements.
We're going to take a very short break here. And when we come back, we'll get a couple phone calls in and ask our workers and our folks, spokespeople here to stay with us. Carrietta Hires, who is an organizer for 1199, and Daniel Roberts, who's a member of 1199 and works at Johns Hopkins University, and Jeff Singer. We'll come back with us for the next few minutes and take a couple calls before we move into our next segment about the future of labor in America. Don't go away. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and continuing our look at history at labor in our country here during this, of course, Mark Steiner Show over the next hour and a half. We'll continue with our workers here. I'll reintroduce, reminding you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner on our website at steinershow.org. We are continuing our conversation here for the next few minutes with Carrietta Hires, who is a longtime organizer for 1199, SEIU 1199 organizer at Hopkins. She's in the middle of these contract negotiations. We're also joined here by Daniel Roberts, who is a member of 1199 and a transporter who's been working at Hopkins for a year and a half and is also working his way through college as he's doing it. Here at Morgan State University, and has to move in and out of that because wage is what keeps him in school, and he has to work to go to school, and we forget that here in our world. Jeff Singer is here with us, a founder and a former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, now teaches at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and is here in this capacity today because he wrote an article after his research on the finance of Hopkins talking about where the money comes from. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. But there's a couple little pieces we did not really tackle here. Oh, and one little sidebar. I got a text from my wife that I have to read to you all because I'd be remiss if I didn't. And where she told me that I made a mistake, which I usually do once, at least once or twice a show. It's not Manor Tavern. It's the Milton Inn on York Road that used to be where the prep school was that John Wilkes Booth went to. So I had to put that out there. Okay, so here we go. So, Carrietta, tell me a bit now about, I'm curious about why the strike ended. Many people don't understand why the strike had to end after 3 days. It's not that you wanted to end it, but was there a law? What was it that forced the end of the strike?
Well, the bargaining committee is comprised of our members. The members actually voted to have the three-day strike. And in thinking strategically about actually performing a strike, you have to think these workers, it's an unpaid strike.
Uh-huh.
That's most importantly, it's an unpaid strike. Now, you had a few workers that wanted to do it for a week, but then we have to sit back and think about we're protesting against our members not being able to afford and not having a livable wage. To have them out on the line for a week or longer than 3 days without proper preparation, it's a hardship.
Right.
We don't want to put our members in a hardship, but you actually had folks who were willing to stand it's on pure principle. They don't appreciate us and they were willing to take that risk.
So how do you feel about that?
I'm glad they did it. And I'm glad they did it that way because there are a lot of people living paycheck to paycheck. So, I mean, for them to miss $100 to $200 is a big hit. I know myself, I actually tried to go back in and get a little overtime just because I know the next time a pay comes around, I don't want to look back and say, geez, that was a pretty big hit, you know. Like I said before, you know, for me, gas is expensive. So, you know, I have to be able to, you know, get back and forth to Hopkins. So, you know, I'm pretty happy they did it that way.
I think that it's important here, and we're going to bring some other guests in here right now in a minute. Mike Lewis from the Steelworkers Union and Bill Fletcher, who's a union activist, to continue the conversation. Our Hopkins workers are going to stay with us for a bit for that part of this conversation, so we can have this dialogue as it that it winds its way over the next hour or so. And I think it's important because what I want to raise with them was that at least your union had the heart to walk out. A lot of unions won't stand up and walk out anymore.
Absolutely.
Even if it's a symbolic walking out, saying we're saying this is not acceptable. Because you're saying you're going back to negotiations, but you might have to walk out again.
We very well have to, yeah.
Not that you want to.
You know what? And that's it. We had buttons that says that we don't want to strike, but we will if we have to. This was a hard decision. We had to sit down and really educate our members on this process because we had some folks have never been in the union before, and we haven't had a strike at Hopkins since 2001. Nobody wants to, and our members actually care about these. You heard Daniel. They care about the patients that they care for. You know, they really care about this. But ultimately, family comes first.
Right. So we're going to take a very short break. We're going to come right back, and I want to thank our guests here for being with us, here from Johns Hopkins, from the union, from 1199. It's one of our storied unions. I remember when Bob Warren and others had formed this union here in Baltimore, 40 years ago.
40 years ago,
as a union, and the work that we all did at that point together with 1199, I have to put that disclaimer out there, for a long time ago, and they're still here fighting for the rights of workers, and it's good to have you here. We are the music you're hearing me out now is Loretta Lynn, because she was born on this day in 1935. Speaking of working class roots, we'll be right back. Don't go away.